The Armed Forces Radio Service invites you to share in the vivid, colorful stories just between us. Stories as told by one of America's master yarn spinners, Knox Manning.
This is Knox Manning with a few remarks just between us about the big melting pot, the ideal job. Don't handle with care, and knives and forks. If you'd ask almost anyone what their mental image of the typical American is, their answer will no doubt run something like this. Well, we're a young people. Most of us live in a growing city or on a farm in a growing state. Most of us work in a factory or on a farm. We are of the melting pot, partaking of all the races and nationalities. Likely as not, our parents were born in Europe. These are some generally held impressions. But not one of these statements is true. The average age of Americans today is 30. It used to be 16. Another way of saying we are rapidly getting to be a nation in which old folk predominate. Most of our cities are not growing, and most of our states are losing population. Twice as many persons are employed in our service industries, trade, transportation, communications, as in factories or on farms. And we're getting to be as American as corn on the cob. Half the babies born in the United States in 1915 had one parent, at least, who was foreign-born. Now, 9 out of 10 babies have 2 American-born parents. We start our families earlier than we used to. The average age of the bridegroom in 1940 was 24.3 years. In 1890, 26.1. The 1940 bride was 21.6 years old. Her grandmother married at 22. Our birth rate, taking the long view, is declining. It fell from 25 births per 1,000 persons in 1915 to a low of 16.6 in 1933. But the birth rate rose to 17.6 in 1940, and to 21.5, its wartime peak, in 1943. The decline then started and is now over. There are 106 boys born for every 100 girls, and this approximate figure prevails the world over. However, males continue to die faster than females all through life, in peace as well as in war. So the ladies finally prevail by a considerable margin. There will be no shortage of husbands except among elders. When Miss America reaches her 21st birthday, her chances of marrying within the year are 15.5 out of 100, and her normal chances of ever marrying are 92 out of 100. 11 out of every 12 persons reaching the age of 15 will eventually marry. Yes, America is aging. Almost one-fourth of our people are over 45 already. Between 1930 and 1940, those over 65 rose about 35%. There will be 3 times as many people over 65 years of age in 1980 as there were in 1930. The increase in the aged will have many effects. An unusually large proportion of our people is now in the employable range of 20 to 59 years of age. More jobs have to be found now. But because fewer persons are approaching 20 and more persons are approaching 59, this large wave of extra workers will ultimately decrease. The rate of growth of our urban population has been slowing up since 1910. Large cities have practically ceased to grow within their corporate limits, with few temporary exceptions. Their suburban areas, however, are growing rapidly and will continue to grow. Half of us now live in 140 metropolitan districts made up of cities of over 50,000 population and adjoining townships. Industry is already beginning to decentralize with more but smaller factories outside the big cities. The proportion of our population on farms was standing still before the war at 23.1%. Every basic trend is against a back-to-the-farm movement. Better methods, better seeds, mechanization, and the wider use of fertilizers made possible vast acres and with fewer workers. The standard of living of those who remain on farms will increase if these better methods and means are used. The number of farms is decreasing, their size increasing. The proportion of our labor force employed in trade, transportation, and the service industries has been increasing for more than 100 years. These fields, excluding government, accounted for 45.8% of our civilians employed persons in 1940. Manufacturing employed 23.4%, while agriculture, forestry, and fisheries combined accounted for only 18.8%. 2 definite mass migrations have taken place in recent years: the Grapes of Wrath Depression migration in the 30s, and the late war boom migration. The West Coast states were big gainers in population, along with Florida. A solid tier of states from North Dakota to Oklahoma were the big losers. Substantial increases in Maryland and Virginia really represent the growth of Washington, which has spilled over its own boundaries. This pattern of migration is a long and basic one, For example, there's no reason to look to a new reverse migration from the West Coast. New factories, more favorable freight rates, climate, and future trade with the Orient are among the factors favoring further growth there. By 1952, the population of Pacific states will probably exceed its war peak by a considerable margin. The West and Southeast will continue to gain, largely at the expense of the North and Northeast. During the war years, the number of women in rural farm areas decreased 11.3% but increased in cities. Of this female migration cityward, 665,000 were between 14 and 24 years of age. These younger women have acquired new wants, tastes, and standards, which will greatly affect their future outlook on life. Our long-run prospects are excellent. These people, of whom you are one, have what it takes. What we do with it is up to us. I wonder how many of us have wished for a job where we could be our own bosses, do a lot of traveling, and where no two assignments would ever be just alike. Sounds like a pipe dream, doesn't it? But Miss Frances Wells of Anchorage, Alaska, does have a job which includes all these things as well as much friendly enjoyment. Miss Wells owns and operates a shopping service, Arctic Trails, it's called, that each year takes care of the shopping problems of hundreds of persons. But Miss Wells' clientele isn't of the get me 200 cases of nuts and bolts kind. Requests come by word of mouth, by mail and ham radio. People who live in the States write her for touring information, maps, and souvenirs they forgot to get last summer. Such things as parkas, mukluks, carved ivory, walrus tusks, etc. But the real business is in Alaska. The outside trade is just a sideline. The customers who live in Alaska order groceries, cat food, buttons, turtles, mining machinery, and so on. 80% of the merchandise is bought by Miss Wells in Anchorage. But through buyer agencies in all parts of the United States, the rarer articles are located. Regardless of how far Miss Wells must go to find them, the standard charge on all articles is 10%. This shopping service doesn't have any price lists or any catalogs. Its motto is merely, we buy anything and ship anywhere. In 1 month not long ago, Miss Wells filled orders for baby chicks, lumber, drugs, firemen's hats, trouser alterations, books. A man who lived in Kodiak sent a wire for 6 pairs of number one horseshoes. After searching for them vainly, Miss Wells inquired, only horseshoes available are official pitching shoes. Will these do? Back came the reply, nope, need these to put between horse and ground. Thanks. A chief living at the Hooper Bay Eskimo settlement got an outboard motor and also 10 big black outside rabbit skins. The rabbit skins were for mukluks, and apparently anyone who is anyone, socially speaking, at that Eskimo settlement wears pelts that are imported. Well, you can see what a job Frances Wells has in getting the stuff and shipping it out. Of course, there's the other big problem, too, of seeing that the merchandise arrives at its destination in usable condition. That can get to be a big problem, too. Did you know that during World War II, the well-known definition of logistics as the right thing at the right place at the right time was revised to include in usable condition? It was estimated that in 1942, only 45% of the materiel shipped arrived in usable condition. But by 1945, the losses had been cut down to 25%, and now it's hoped that it will be even less than 5%. A great deal of credit for reducing the losses goes to the Packaging Development Branch of the Engineer Research and Development Laboratories at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. You see, their aim is to prevent damage to materiel, either because of shipment in faulty containers, or from internal damage, such as results from corrosion or fungi. And believe me, it's a big job. The container must, for example, be designed so that it can be moved by truck, rail, ship, airplane, glider, or any other transportation available. It must be designed so that it can be safely dropped from the air, moved on rollers, handled by forklift trucks, lifted in a cargo net, and dragged by a tractor without damage to the contents. Each of these problems is met and solved by a specially designed testing device in the up-to-date packaging laboratory. First, containers are subjected to a vibration test, which simulates the vibrations and jogs encountered during all methods of transportation, such as rough roadbeds, car sway, and so on. Containers of all types are tested with this apparatus, and after the effects of vibration are measured, the container is corrected or discarded. Next, a revolving hexagonal drum determines the ability of the container to withstand rough handling. Then the container is given an incline impact test, which determines its ability to withstand impact stresses. These and other tests determine how well a container will stand up and what changes in design should be made to improve it. After this, there is a second big job at the packaging laboratory, preventing deterioration of materiel during shipment or in storage. Extreme temperatures, rain, sand, mud, humidity, and salt spray must be taken into consideration. For these tests, there are climatic laboratories, accelerated weathering machines, and a submersion tank. Although the packaging development branch can duplicate in its own laboratory almost any conditions met in the field, nevertheless, quite a bit of testing is also carried on in the field under actual handling and storage conditions. So favorable have been the results from this continuous research that many of the practices developed have been adopted by private industry for both domestic and overseas shipment and storage. So, although the destination is the North Pole, an African jungle, or just the next town, the packaging development branch will see that the order arrives safely, whether the item is a D8 tractor, a fragile incandescent light bulb, or a shipment of new knives and forks for the mess hall. Since we seem to have wound up with silverware, did you know the people didn't start using eating forks until considerably after spoons and knives were in common use at table? Eating forks were first used in Italy, but for years forks were regarded as a superfluous luxury. The fact is that writers of that day exhorted people not to use them. One Italian writer, in a letter to a lady, warned her against the sins of luxury by telling her about the wife of a Venetian doge whose luxurious way of living was beyond imagining. According to him, he wrote, she would not even wash in common water, but had the cruelty to compel her servants to collect rainwater for her. But what is more monstrous, this wicked creature would not eat with her fingers, but absolutely had her food cut into pieces rather small by her attendants, and then she actually conveyed them to her mouth with certain golden two-pronged forks. For many hundreds of years, forks were considered so precious that they were listed with the most costly and valuable possessions of nobles and royalty. After Edward I of England died in 1307, there was included in an inventory of his treasures one gold fork, six silver forks, and one pair of table knives with crystal handles. Forks were also listed on the inventories of other kings as though they had been crown jewels. For a long time, the people of England held out against using forks in their country. In fact, the English regarded users of forks as sinners. The first fork was brought to England from Italy by a man named Thomas Coriate. While traveling in Italy, he'd seen the Italians using forks when they ate their meat, and it seemed to him so much cleaner than touching the food with fingers that he thought that this was a good custom to imitate. But Coriate was laughed at for his affectation, satirized on the stage as the fork-carrying traveler, and sternly rebuked from the pulpit for his impiety in assuming that God's good gifts were unfit to be touched by human hands. One English author asked, why should a man make hay of his food and pitch it into his mouth with a fork? It was generally considered that the best eating implement was the tip of a knife, unless the person wanted to put on unnecessary dog. Although Coriate's friends didn't go along with his ideas about using forks, he kept on using one despite others' ridicule. And eventually, society did accept the table fork. Using table forks greatly affected table manners, and not only that, but also greatly influenced the development of cookery. There were more solid foods used. Before then, when all people had to eat with were the spoon and knife, it was necessary to cook food to a soft stew. Forks also promoted cleanliness, which was unknown in the time when fingers were the sole eating requirement. It was some time after forks were in common use before the hostess was expected to furnish silverware for the guests. A gentleman who was invited to dinner either brought his own knife, fork, and spoon with him, or sent them by his servant. Well, I don't have a servant here to tell me, but I see that my time is up, so just between us, that's it for today.
You have just heard Knox Manning in another of his informal and informative programs of storytelling, Just Between Us. This program was produced by Carl Hoffenberg. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.